Thank you, Michael. I'd like to invite all our speakers back up onto the stage, please, and we'll go with the questions and answers. And again, I'd like to reiterate that questions from the audience live as well as by SMS are more than welcome. Please stand up at the microphone if you want to ask a question from the floor.
Thank you. Rob Curtis, KPMG UK. It was really a question for Tim, just reflecting back on your comments earlier. Our initial study in terms of the cost of regulation has been it's about $25 billion a year for the industry in aggregate. And we've said, well, this is because the cost of regulation is so high because there's so much bespoke requirements. And I was just wondering, is it in Australia's interest to try and encourage APRA to be part of that? Because Australia already has some of the highest capital requirements in the world as we see it. And so moving to a consistent approach to capital, for example, globally, would probably be perhaps of benefit to the local industry. So I was just wanting your views on some of that.
So, yeah, we would fully support that.
Your comments just earlier sort of seemed to say, well, this is all very sort of, over the top, and we're getting more regulation from other sort of, international players and all that sort of stuff, and maybe APRA's going too far. But I was just wondering, from our analysis, actually APRA is already, in terms of your minimum capital requirements, it's already 99.5, which is the top level of Solvency II, for example. So you'd sort of say, well, isn't APRA already at the high end of that, and any global, framework would actually potentially be of benefit to the industry coming perhaps down to a more common level that might be of, some value.
So I think I'm saying I do support it. One of the challenges is, I think, you see the calculator. So there's two elements to the total capital requirements as well. So there's a capital required, the PCA, and then there's the capital, or the PCR, and then there's the components of capital as well. And it feels like, maybe it's not true, but it feels like every time you ask a question about ambiguity and how would you interpret this, it's always ruled on the conservative side in addition to the one in the 99.5 percentile. Getting a global capital standard, if you could really trust it, would be fantastic for companies like mine, or companies like the one I work for, because I think it'd quite level up the playing field. I mean, a lot of the challenge, though, is Solvency II is slowed down more in the life space than it is in the general insurance space, I think, and many of the big players in Europe are actually composites, so they can't agree to the general insurance in isolation. They've got to agree to the combined, and that's one of the this liquidity premium type argument on the long term savings plans and the variable annuity type stuff. That's a really difficult issue for them to solve. The other point I guess we'd support is kind of this independent umpire, if you like, just to go back and test objectively from outside both the industry and APRA or Wallace II type inquiry, and have we got it right, and to test the balance that way. Be definitely worthwhile.
Ian, I think there was sort of an implied second part of the question from the APRA perspective on that as well, if you want to make any comments.
I do indeed. A couple of points. Lowest common denominator is one. I mentioned earlier, a global capital standard, when and if it comes into place, is going to have to cater for a whole range of different standards. And so we're a long way from being in the situation where we have a global capital standard, and B, it's set at a level that I think the Australian community would find acceptable. Okay, so I make that point. Second point I'd note is that the industry at the moment is about 1.8 times PCA, okay, across the board. So that's a very healthy position to be in, But it also suggests that companies are quite comfortable with holding a fairly high level of capital. And the last point I'd make is that Solvency II. Now, Solvency II is a very sophisticated model. It's very complex. It's been going for 15-odd years. I'll be gone from APRA by the time it comes into play. And don't hold your breath for when it actually starts. My understanding is that the cost of implementing it, and Rob, you might be able to confirm these figures. They could even be KPMG figures, I'm not sure. The cost of implementing it in the UK so far, and this is just the cost of implementation, you know, systems, people, et cetera, is about £2 billion, the last figure I saw. So be careful what you ask for, okay? If the world adopted something like Solvency II, it would be extremely complex. Imagine how long it would take to actually get up and running, get the agreement of the whole world, not just the agreement of European countries, okay? So I'm not sure it's a great idea. If we can end up with something simple as a really, as a backstop, to use the FSB's term, around the world, so that at least a country can say, yes, we're jumping that particular hurdle, I think that would be a good place to be. But we're a long way from that.
So can I just have a follow-up on that? So, Ian, just with that, though, how does the IIS, the supervisors, actually bring together the different regulatory views on this? You know, I've obviously been involved in it for a long time, and, you know, I'm not asking that question as a... but in the sense of how do we practically actually move to a, you know, a position where you can start getting agreement? Because the cost to the industry is very real by having bespoke requirements on whether it be risk management, capital requirements, reporting, you know, valuation, risk management. You know, every country is asking for something different. And for a large internationally active group, it actually does become a real cost issue in terms of not being able to have necessarily a consistent globally, you know, rolled out program against all those different features. And it sort of seems as though each supervisor, you know, irrespective of where you go in the world, so it has a view of, well, it's all very difficult and, you know, it's going to take ages and, you know, we might as well stick with what we've got here. And you sort of think, well, when do we get to a point, though, that everyone says, well, actually, you know, we've got to start seriously moving towards something?
Well, I mean, we could talk about this all day, and believe me, it's a painful topic when you get into it. But I mentioned earlier the straightforward backstop measure that the FSB has requested from October next year. So that's a good starting point. And the IAIS has agreed to that. Okay, so it's committing to do something, which is a huge leap forward. And then the second thing is the proposal, and I'm not sure that the IAIS is committed to this, but the proposal that at least for internationally active insurance groups that there be a global capital standard. Okay, so there is work going on an international standard for internationally active groups already through ComFrame, but that's proving hugely difficult as well. Without getting into the politics of it, America's approach is extremely different to the European approach, and you see that in all sorts of different ways, and believe me, it's alive and well in the insurance regulatory space. So just getting those two groups to agree is a major challenge.
Ian, a few general comments, sort of going pretty much, I guess, to the heart of the balance between prudential regulation versus market competition and access. If one stands back and looks at the last decade since the fairly traumatic event of the HIH collapse, you have a situation where the prudential capital requirement and its predecessor, the MCR, were intended to be broadly calibrated to a 1 in 200 year probability of insolvency, and by that I mean full insolvency, I don't mean regulatory insolvency. And while I don't wish to be interpreted as calling for more insurance insolvencies, they seem to be a bit thin on the ground over the last decade compared with that criterion. You then look at pretty high insurance margins being reported by a number of the listed groups, and partly, as Tim says, due to an absence of local catastrophes, but not entirely. If you look at the period of the previous 3 or 4 years when the reverse was the case, they're still pretty respectable insurance margins. And you look at high market shares for the two largest groups in the personal line space in Australia, and you have to wonder as to whether all of that does suggest that the balance has tipped a little too far in terms of prudential regulation and high levels of minimum capitalisation, and a little too far against barriers to entry and effective competition and consumer benefits that flow from that.
Okay. Let me tackle that on a couple of fronts. One is, how do you get to 99.5%? And that's a judgment call. It's an issue ultimately for the community. I mean, the community could, through the government, say to us, in fact, that's too high. And, you should shoot for 98% for argument's sake, or 95%. And that would be a legitimate thing for the community to actually do, if that's what it chose to do. As it stands, we've got 99.5%. That's been in place, as you said, Adrian, for some time. And to me, that sort of is the barrier, the boundary between the protecting the interests of policyholders and the market, some of the market issues that Tim raised. So in other words, you've got to meet that threshold requirement of protection of policyholders. Once you've done that, then you're open to other influences. The 99.5%, though, we've got no plans of shifting from that. But as I say, it's up to the community if it chose to move that figure. The second point I make is that very often when we have these conversations with industry, whether it's with individual companies or the industry at large, the point that we are interested in the tail, the very tail of outcomes, is often lost. Okay, so talking about the last 10 years, and the last year has been a good one for the industry and so on, is interesting stuff. But it's largely irrelevant when you're talking about the tail. We're talking about 1 in 200. And so whilst the interest of boards and management primarily focus on the here and now and maybe the next couple of years and how they'll manage through various issues, we're actually saying that's fine, but we're actually interested in the far tail. And that gives you a different sort of focus. Okay, so it's good that the industry's healthy. It's good that we haven't had a failure for 10 years. It's good that they're profitable right now, but that's just grist for the mill at the end of the day.
Sorry, could you actually just grab one of the microphones?
I guess following up on that, Ian, you talk about the 1 in 200, and that's fine, but are we possibly at 1 in 500? If we did the modelling, would you come up with a different number? And if you did, would you unwind any of the regulation?
So I think the question is, we're nominally 1 in 200, but in reality we're 1 in 500. And of course what we've done is not perfect. Of course it's got weaknesses in it, and of course it can be improved and so on. But as we developed LAGIC, as best we could, we tried to calibrate it to 1 in 200. And I'm sure we haven't got it right, but that's where we've actually ended up. Now, if we were miles off the pace, a long way off the pace, then that's a legitimate challenge. And, if the industry were to demonstrate to us that we had the calibration really wrong, then we'd have to sit up and take notice. Because we're not sort of sitting here saying it's 1 in, superficially it's 1 in 200, but, we know we've got the real numbers here and it's not 1 in 200, it's a lot stronger than that. We're not doing that. Okay. Now, I take somebody's point earlier that we do tend to be conservative. So given a choice between, when we're asked a particular question, given a choice between saying, yeah, okay, we'll let that one through, actually we'll take a conservative position, we do tend to take the conservative position. And I think if you add them up, then there's an argument that maybe we've been a bit too conservative overall.
Just got a comment on sort of the incidence of default and likelihood of default here, as to sort of try to judge 1 in 200 to 500, but when we look at our default statistics as an industry, the insurance sector defaults less than all other sectors, and our average ratings are the highest but for sovereign ratings. So that is sort of, in effect, there's some, you know, justification for average ratings being higher and sort of probability of default being lower. You know, how you translate that to Australia's history of default in 10 years, I'm not sure, but it's just a view.
Adrian, can I just make a further comment? As I mentioned earlier, we are taking a very keen interest in PMLs for cap risk purposes and associated management of cap risks. There are a couple of things that surprise me and bother me about the market practice, the general market practice. One is that very often a company chooses to go for the APRA minimum. Now, why would you do that and not, you know, go through a more sophisticated approach, understand your risk appetite, and pitch your PML accordingly? That's what should be happening. It's hard to believe that everybody thinks 1 in 200 is actually the right answer. The second thing is that, as I touched on earlier, and certainly you'll hear more from us on this, that when the industry or when an individual company thinks they're covering themselves at 1 in 200 level for cat risk, the one thing they can be really sure of is if they're just using the output of a model, they are wrong. And they're probably exposing the company to a lot more risk because of the uncertainty in that number than they understand. Okay, so this is sort of the flip side, where the company thinks they're shooting at 1 in 200, and they might be 1 in 200, they might be 1 in 150, they might be 1 in 120. They just don't know it because of the uncertainty in the model.
Instead of continually putting Ian on the spot, a question perhaps more for both Tim and Michael. Capital can be defined and calculated by looking at regulatory insolvency, economic insolvency, P&L volatility. Each of those has a rationale and potentially important, and each is going to give a different capital amount, or likely to give a different capital amount. Both in the context of ICAP and more broadly, do you have views about where insurers' focus should be? And I appreciate that that probably depends on where you are relative to the regulatory capital minimum.
Now, we set a risk appetite and then calculate the target capital off the back of that. When we do the calculation, we first look at regulatory insolvency, so that's the first metric we look at. The reason why we do that is because we're trying to, board's job is to balance shareholder and policyholder views, and regulatory insolvency is the point where APRA quite rightly comes in and takes over, and therefore the rights of the shareholders get subordinated to the rights of the policyholders. So that's the first view we look at. But when we're doing the discussion with the board, we don't look at that in isolation. We're competing in a marketplace where Standard & Poor's and rating agencies are very important on broker lists. So having decided the answer first to give our regulatory security, if you like, we then go and look at what the rating agency would say on that aspect. We also look at the probability of real economic insolvency. So how do we go through the top of the cat tower, and how far do we have to go through the top of the cat tower to blow up all the policyholder money, or how bad does inflation have to get? It's interesting we don't talk much about reserve risk here, and yet it's still a material risk for us all, and inflation on our reserves is a principal risk. So it's interesting it hasn't been mentioned until this point. We mentioned insurance risk, but not reserve risk in isolation. So that's interesting. So we look at those views, and then we obviously look at where our competitors are sitting as well, as a kind of fourth level of it. So we look at all angles. Start off though with the regulatory insolvency as the kind of starting point, and then compare the others.
Yeah, not a lot to, more to add other than, you know, yes, agree, as I sort of mentioned in the presentation, that, you know, the first thing we'd look at is not breaching regulatory insolvency, and then, you know, if not, moving on to our own view of capital. Look, we've got to be aware it is a model, and, you know, there are inputs that analysts can make adjustment to, and issues as to how you treat very large reinsurance recoverables after an event, or how do you treat a bias to Australian bank investment assets and the concentration risk for that. And that was something, for example, in our sort of new criteria, that we were able to take an adjustment for that on the basis that it's probably closer to a sovereign type supported bank risk rather than a standalone bond concentration risk. So these are issues with modelling that probably that there's some analytic oversight to determine the outcome. So it's probably a range of those issues.
And that does raise another element to it. There's quite a lot of risks, and you mentioned the default on the Australian banking debt that we hold and others hold, that you actually can't get a useful metric about the probability of it. So you explore it in the scenarios, you explore it in your discussion with the board, but actually it's just almost a policy statement rather than a risk appetite statement, because you can't flex it too much. You just set it and manage it, and then periodically you bring it back to the board to explain and discuss it. One other thing I think is worthwhile mentioning, when we talk about risk appetite where I work, we actually acknowledge that we're not modelling the range of management actions a general insurer can take when you get into trouble. And there is a huge range of them, and they're very effective. So what we did through the stress and scenarios is actually explored what circumstances would reduce the effectiveness of those management actions that can put the company back on track if you get into difficulties. And that differs. A bank doesn't have the time, it doesn't have the circumstances, a general insurer does. And I think a lifey, as I said before, somewhere in between. So it's an important criteria for us to keep as general insurers in our minds, that you can raise capital, you potentially can raise capital, you can potentially go out and buy more reinsurance, you can close down to new business, and closing down a new business gives you time for your cat risk, you've got 12 months before your cat risk runs off totally. But there's a lot of things you can do to secure the rights of the policyholders when things go wrong. So I think it's worthwhile keeping that in mind, and our board keeps that in mind.
Well, there is actually a question on liquidity risk, but I think that in large part that Tim's probably answered that already, so I possibly might move on. An old chestnut, but possibly relevant for both Ian and Michael. Pillar 2 adjustments to capital have been stated are not common. Perhaps, Ian, could I ask you to sort of reiterate the rationale and justification for the disclosure of those adjustments not being permissible? And I'd ask Michael if he's got any comments as to whether that's a significant hindrance or not to the from the ratings agency perspective.
Okay, let me just make some general comments about Pillar 2, first of all. Pillar 2 is used reasonably often in the ADI space. When we developed LAGIC, we tried to capture the vast bulk of risks in the standard approach. And as a consequence, we were hoping that there would be few Pillar 2 adjustments actually needed in the insurance industry. And by and large, that's true. There aren't many Pillar 2 adjustments in the insurance industry in Australia. So just bear that in mind for a second. The argument for not disclosing Pillar 2 adjustments is basically that if you disclose the fact that we came along and decided that 100 was no longer adequate for this company and they were going to increase it to 120, the obvious question would be, well, why are you doing that? And the answer would be, we probably are not very comfortable with the way the company is being managed or with its capital position or whatever it is. And, of course, what's that going to do but undermine market confidence in the company and potentially just initiate a problem that wasn't there in the first place? or magnify a problem that there actually was. So that's the basic rationale for keeping them confidential.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a number of scores from APRA that have remained confidential for many years, and certainly the companies that we rate through discussions with management have adhered to that, you know, very strictly. Look, it probably would be nice to know to factor in and some of these other issues, and, you know, how would one then, you know, score that? Would it be through, you know, management and governance or our own capital model adjustments, etc.? But I think we, you know, respect probably the almost the, you know, doctor-patient relationship or client privilege, whatever analogy you want to make, with the regulator, and, you know, we can, you know, actively and sort of onerously move sort of independently ourselves. You know, the other thing is, you know, if we are in receipt of confidential information, how do we act on it without divulging the confidential information? So sometimes it can be a hindrance to rating action if perhaps, you know, we've got a fundamental concern as well. It's probably opening the door to access to actuarial reports and all sorts of things which we don't need to go into.
Okay. This is an extraordinarily sweeping question we have on the SMS stream. The Australian banking industry continually earns significantly higher returns on capital, and I guess that must be subscribed balance sheet capital, than the Australian insurance industry. Is this because it's riskier, it's subject to less competition, or some other reason? And what are the implications of the answer for regulation? Is anyone brave enough to have a crack at that?
Let me make a couple of comments. One is that APRA, of course, doesn't regulate prices, and it's not a market conduct regulator, but nor does ASIC regulate prices either. So that's just there in the background, and then you'd have to say, well, if that's the case, then what must be driving the position is largely the market and the competition. There are people who understand this a lot better than I do, but that's how I would answer that.
Question from the audience?
Elaine Collins. I've got a question unrelated to that previous very sweeping one. This is around the balance between board responsibilities and management responsibilities. So I'm a new director, so I came into the process when the ICAP was really at the end. However, I was interested in comments earlier where Scott mentioned that boards almost got too involved in the whole ICAP process, and Ian mentioned that boards need to take ownership of the ICAP documents. So I'm interested in how you see the responsibilities being balanced out.
I'm happy to make a comment. Do you want to comment any further, Scott, in the first instance? Okay, so it's easy to get the balance wrong, and in all of these situations, it's a function of the personalities on the board, the personalities of the chairman, the way that management interacts with the board, and so on. So there's no universal answer here. We sometimes get accused, though, of expecting boards to do management work, and you can understand where that criticism comes from when you look at the number of times in our prudential standards we say that the board is responsible for something. Okay, you can find, I did count it once, and I can't remember what the number is. It's a very large number. And so, as Kate mentioned earlier, we're in the process of doing a bit of a stock take to understand just how many references there are of this and whether or not we can rationalise it. However, having said that, we are really conscious that we're consciously trying to avoid putting the board in management's shoes. What we are trying to do is to say, board, you are responsible for governance here. You're responsible for ensuring that the business is managed, it's controlled, the interests of policyholders are looked after, and so on. They're your high-level responsibilities. And by and large, what we're trying to do is to say the way you can do that, a good way of doing it, is as set out in our prudential standards. And we sometimes hear conversations, we might go and talk to a board, for example, or more likely management, and we start hearing references to compliance with APRA standards. And that always gets me agitated because it's the wrong sort of mentality. It's not about just doing something to comply with APRA standards. What we're trying to do is to put in place a good framework and a good standard for boards and management to work to, which is in the interest, ultimately very often in the interest of shareholders, just as much as it is in the interest of policyholders, but ultimately in the interest of policyholders.
I'll just add to that. I think the comments that I would have reported on essentially come from management, the actuary or the risk managers, and from their perspective, I'd say it was a case of the board getting closer to the day-to-day management than they were used to and being sort of dragged down that path a little bit. The boards took to it with some gusto, but I think it was part of the ICAAP process was to actually bring the boards into capital management and risk appetite setting in a more explicit and obvious way. And that inevitably created, you know, a situation where boards were doing things that they weren't used to and things that management weren't used to. And in some cases, management might have thought, well, you know, the boards are getting a bit overexcited about this. But I think in reality, that was just the boards taking their responsibilities seriously.
I guess a fairly closely related question. I don't think I'm alone in being confused by some of the references to first, second, and third line of defences in Ian's earlier comments and in some of the written submissions in relation to CPS 220. If line management's the first line of defence and persons in essentially review roles like the mooted CRO role, sometimes the AAO's second line of defence, the definition of the third line of defence is that essentially meant to be the line of the role of the board? And if so, how is that squared with the fact that the board is responsible for the activities of lines one and two as well, having overall responsibility?
Yeah, I mean, third line is normally more audit functions, internal audit and external audit, so very objective assessment of compliance with processes and that sort of thing. The board obviously, though, has to overview all of that. And one of the reasons we're keen, therefore, to have a board risk committee distinct from a board audit committee is so that they can focus appropriately on those different responsibilities, those different aspects of managing and controlling the company. While I've got it in mind, can I just comment briefly, Adrian, on CPS 220? Tim mentioned this earlier. We get arguments, we have had arguments that, you know, we're thinking like bankers, we APRA are thinking like bankers, and you know, the implication is how dare you take banking thinking and apply it to insurers. Now, I've never worked for a bank. Kate, I don't think you've ever worked for a bank, and you've largely worked in insurance and so on. There are lots of people within APRA quite able to express themselves who have a good understanding of insurance. So why would we have a uniform standard, as proposed, going across ADIs, general insurers and life insurers? As I mentioned earlier, the starting point is actually what we are doing in insurance and applying it to ADIs. Okay, so if you go and have a look at what's currently there, this is more about taking the good standards and practices that have developed in general insurance 10 years ago, life insurance about 5 or 6 years ago, I think, and saying, okay, well, how can we pick all of that up, pick the eyes out of both of them? By the way, general insurance and life insurance were similar but not consistent. How can we pick the eyes out of all of them and apply good practice across all of those industries? And that's what we're proposing. Now, to pick an item, a particular risk that might be only peculiar to banking, there was a question before about liquidity risk, and saying, well, why would you have a uniform standard when liquidity risk is not that relevant for general insurance? Well, if it's not that relevant, then it should be treated accordingly. So it's not a great imposition to recognise that liquidity risk is there. It might be minimal for general insurers and it might be significant for a bank, they should be dealt with accordingly. But we will, you know, assuming we do go ahead and implement this, we will end up with consistency and the best practices from each of the different areas. So that's the thinking.
The next question may have been prompted by Tim's remarks, or then again, it may not. Inflation and underpricing and under-reserving of claims inflation led to most of the insurance company solvency problems of the 1990s. Inflation risk hasn't been mentioned much by the panel, who focused on natural cat and sovereign bond risk. Are we in danger of underplaying this risk following the benign last decade? Kate, do you want to have a crack at that one?
Really? No, I don't. I think, you know, that probably the fact that we've listed here that it was, you know, the problems of the 1990s, I think I've read a lot of ILVRs. And in my time looking at those, that's an area where it gets a lot of attention. Same with financial condition reports. I think there's a lot more, you know, that's certainly one of the areas where there's a lot more focus by the appointed actuary as well in commenting on those things. I definitely think there's a risk that we could underplay that. We never know post-GFC, post-Queensland floods, we never know where the next risk is coming. It's probably most likely not to be something that we've seen before, but I think this is something that is recognised. I know I've had a number of conversations with Tim before about inflation and other accumulations, vertical requirement, for example, in the ICRC. So I think it definitely still gets attention. And I don't think it's at risk of being underplayed, but, you know, we're happy to introduce a risk charge for that if you like. Does anyone want me to do that?
Question from the audience?
Yeah, just to remind you, Kate, it's already there. And for most general insurers, it's a big part of the asset charge. Capital charges for long-term classes are much higher than for short-term classes, so there could be a double count there as well. And I'll stop there. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks, Stephen. I'm aware that there's an inflation risk charge in the asset risk charge. Thank you. Something that we spent a lot of time on, as you know, but we're always, as Ian said before, happy to receive feedback about whether or not we haven't got that quite right. In looking forward to your submission.
A very broad question that sort of goes back to the question of cost balance of insurance regulation. Initially, for Tim, I guess as AA of one of Australia's largest insurance groups, what's your general perspective of the extent to which compliance activities, following on from Ian's bugbear of using that phrase, compliance with regulatory requirements sort of impairs the ability of your team to add value elsewhere in the group's operations?
I try to put in my presentation, it's not so much the cost of compliance, but the changing focus. If you want to have risk embedded, you want people thinking about things that are material to them. And if you put something that has a compliancy feel, you're driving them away from the true culture you're trying to get across the organisation. And that's the risk I see. The other kind of risk, so we've got to be able to, everything we do, we should be able to describe to business about why it's important and how it fits in. And yeah, business sometimes forgets about tail risk, so we need to bring that to their attention, and stress and scenarios is a good way of doing that, but there's other ways of doing it across there. The other thing that is kind of interesting at the moment, there seems to be, it's a bit Ian's challenge that he threw at us before. It's very hard for a regulator to come in, and if they've seen one way of it happening and being applied in a business model in company X, they come in and use that as the benchmark to look at company Y. And company Y might be doing it in a different way and a different manner that fits the culture and the way it's been implemented there. And so that's it's a big challenge and a big risk, I think, to building one standard fits all. I have the same issue a bit with internal capital models as well, that you may actually mitigate a lot of small risks but build a systemic kind of global risk by just saying this one practice, this is the way we're going to apply it for all insurance companies. I don't think that it's happening, but I do think we can get pushed in a way that doesn't fit your business model optimally.
And I think that's a fair challenge. So one of the challenges for APRA is to make sure that we don't become too narrow in our thinking.
A question on the SMS. Rightly noting, there's been a lot of discussion about managing risk and capital on the downside. What does the panel think about the role of the CRO in managing risk and capital as an enabler of achieving upside strategic and growth aspirations?
Let me comment. It's risk management. It's not risk avoidance or risk minimisation. And I think the CRO has got a really important role to do just that. But there's other aspects of the role as well that are important ultimately to policyholders.
I would agree 100%. I mean, any CRO who comes in and just goes one side will lose business relevance and the ability to influence very, very quickly, and it'll be a horrible kind of auditing type job you'll have to do, and it'll be very ineffective. So I think it's a must. It's got to be an enterprise risk type approach. It's got to work within a risk return trade-off to really make the position valuable.
Yeah, I mean, we view insurance organisations are in the business of taking risk, and its profit or loss depends on how it manages that. So, you know, there's the theory and sort of enterprise risk management of the upside of risk, and, you know, using it for positive strategic outcomes that make sense, but, you know, ultimately it's for, you know, can be used for good and growth, etc. Interesting to come back to the earlier question about someone asking whether, you know, why banks were more profitable than insurers. I mean, arguably they're leveraged so much more to assets, and fundamentally, you know, that could be seen as taking, you know, more risk, but it's probably difficult to compare like with like because of the, you know, perhaps the cat risk, etc. on the GI side.
I guess a related follow-up question for you, Michael, fairly broad. Your perceptions about improvements in insurance risk management during the last decade, and perhaps particularly over the last couple of years in response to LAGIC, I guess most particularly in Australia, but with any broader perspective you're able to add?
I mean, certainly since, I suppose, you know, for the last decade or so, you know, since HIH, et cetera, I mean, the industry fundamentals have improved, and I think it's principally through the improvements and strength and resources through regulation, Australia being sort of leading in that field globally against others. We've had access to foreign subsidiaries of major reinsurance and insurance groups that have brought the best of risk management and oversight to Australia as well. I think we've been open to new ideas and the best of practices. Fundamentally, probably a view of Australians and managing risk is not dissimilar to perhaps Canadians and South Africans who are sort of historically used to managing the wilds and exposures and the great outdoors a long way away from England and Scotland and the like. So the sort of self-preservation of management of risks, but still taking on risks, is something that probably differentiates us. You know, yes, things sort of went wrong the 10 years ago or more now. What is it, 13 years ago? But the recent initiatives, I think, have definitely improved and strengthened the industry. You know, how we translate that to rating outcome, I think, is probably more stability. It's improved rating agency capital model outcomes as well, and through our various scoring of management and governance and the various enterprise risk management type scoring as well as is improved, such that, you know, we do have strong assessed companies locally. Could probably go on sort of a long way, but I'll pass on the baton.
Please, I have a bit of an issue with this. I was working as a general insurance actuary during HIH times, and that wasn't a systemic failure of risk management across the across the industry. It was isolated. And so please don't put me in the same brush. And I guess there's a lot of actuaries out here who would say the same. I mean, it was known to be reserved without prudential margins, taking optimistic assumptions. People, other insurance companies, people on the know weren't dealing with it. Brokers were beginning to take them off their lists. It was a known issue, but it was isolated from the rest of us, or partially isolated. So whether we've improved in the 10 years since, or whether that was a one-off, let's ask that question too.
I think it's a fair observation. I mean, a sweeping generalisation, you can say that, you know, banks tend to fail systemically in swathes, whereas insurers tend to fail individually through their own ineptitude, basically. And HIH did it in a big way and in multiple causes, I think. Can we finish with one final question from the SMS, possibly for Kate and Ian, and any observations Scott has, that regulation drives behaviour. We're now in the early stages, sort of post-LAGIC implementation. Are there any signs or concerns that the balance of risk charges within the prescribed capital requirement may be leading to suboptimal outcomes or surprising trends?
I'm just to make a few comments. We did look quite in a lot of detail around the balance between the different risk categories when we looked at the quantitative impact studies during the development of LAGIC, and we were quite satisfied with where the balance ended in the quiz, and we did take what we thought were sensible management actions into account when we were looking at that. So, for example, when we introduced the asset concentration risk charge, we were attempting to encourage behaviour of insurers. We weren't expecting to see the large numbers that came out in the quiz continue 1st January 2013 because we were attempting to drive behaviour as well as capital requirements. Now, of course, management actions that did happen before and after 1 January 2013 aren't necessarily exactly what we expected, and obviously the deferral of the horizontal requirement, for example, has an impact on that as well. So we have Ian mentioned earlier, we've got a focus now on looking at some of the calculations, ensuring that they're bedded down and that they're of a good quality, and so we'll continue to look at that. I think it's too early to say whether the balance has been put, you know, one way or the other. I definitely agree that the regulations and, you know, for example, the horizontal requirement definitely drives behaviour, but some of those behaviours can be quite positive. We've seen a lot of consideration of scenarios now that we've considered the horizontal requirement. There's definitely been more focus we've seen around asset and liability management, matching, etc., and looking at scenarios, as I think we've talked about quite a lot around looking at scenarios rather than just that prescribed capital amount. So, Ed.
Scott, any final comments?
I'd agree it's too early. I think I would say I don't know if you'll ever find out the answer to whether the operational risk charge is going to have an impact. You could wait a long time before you find out anything there. I think the asset risk charge, far more complex now. It certainly produces a skew as far as anyone with long tail reserves and the inflation expectation charge, and insurers are left in a situation of not really having access to the sort of assets they need to hedge that away. So maybe someone will come up with something creative, but for the time being, I don't think there's a lot happening there. I think I mean, you can look at the untouched aspects of the regulation, so the insurance risk charge in particular, and whether the balance between, say, quite low charges on motor versus quite high charges on long tail classes has produced any sort of a skew over the last 10 years since that was introduced. I think know, the evidence is there that a lot of foreign insurers have decided to come and come into the motor market, you know, that, and certainly would suggest that the capital for motor, pure motor insurer isn't too high, or it's certainly not discouraging people from coming into the market. On the long tail side, you know, generally the last 10 years has been pretty profitable for long tail insurers. So does that suggest that the risk charges are too high? It probably doesn't. You know, it's one 10-year period. So I'm not sure you can say anything too much about that.
Okay, thanks, Scott. We'd better leave it there. Can I remind you to ask you to complete in the feedback survey and return them either electronically or hard copy? And could you also please express your appreciation for our panel speakers?